Well, good morning. I won't waste a lot of time on introductions this morning. I've already been with you for a couple of lessons, and I have a lot that I intended to get done in this lesson this morning, so I will get right into it. I do want to begin by suggesting that the title of the series I just noticed on the sign this morning is Cultivating Godly Families, and I made a big deal, I think, on Saturday morning about building marriages and using that metaphor which the scripture uses about our marriage relationships and our families. But cultivating is certainly another great metaphor that is scriptural about raising children, at least. That terminology used to be just the standard way in which we talked about parenting, raising children, but as is usually the way, when the experts get involved in that, they want to change the terminology. So raising children has fallen into disfavor, and now they take the word parent and turn it into a verb to parent, and now they turn it back into a noun so they can talk about parenting or nurturing children. But raising children really is a very great and adequate metaphor. They grow up before. It's like tender plants. Seed is sown, and then they need to be nourished. They need to be kept safe in cultivation to keep the weeds out and to allow them their full scope for growth. So cultivating godly families is certainly a beautiful metaphor for us to keep in mind as we think about our marriages and we think about our children. This morning, principally, I want to begin thinking about that which we as parents owe to our children. And sometimes, of course, the whole issue of children coming into the world just seems so natural, we don't give much thought to it. I ask my students from time to time in the class, why would you want to ever have children? Why do you want to have children? We've done surveys around the country. Why do you want to have children? And people start saying things like, well, to provide for me in my old age, to carry on the family name. There are a variety of different sort of reasons they make up, but those are not the real reasons that we have children. Ultimately, the reasons that we have children is because that's what God intended for us under normal circumstances, that we should reproduce, that we should have children, and that some of the greatest pleasures in our life come out of our families. Most people who grew up in families with godly parents just naturally think, I'm going to have children one of these days myself. In some ways, of course, that's the natural thing to do, that we pass on the blessings that we receive from our parents to our children, and that it would be a selfish thing indeed for us to just take the blessings that our parents have given us, the attention they've bestowed upon us, and let it end with us and not pass it forward to the next generation. Sometimes, of course, we think about that seriously. After we have children, what are we supposed to do with them now that we have them? And particularly when problems arise, how do we resolve these issues? And what am I supposed to do in this circumstance or another circumstance? And every child is different. Every situation is different. General principles, of course, are going to hold true throughout all of those variety of circumstances. But what exactly is it that we owe our children when we bring them into the world? Sometimes we might even ask the question, what do children owe their parents? Sometimes our children may, in fact, in bad circumstances, when they get a little older, they may turn that question around on us and say that we brought them into the world. They didn't ask to be born, and place all the burden and responsibility on us. Well, of course, probably they didn't have the opportunity to ask to be born. If they had had the opportunity, I'm pretty sure they would have asked to be born. But nonetheless, here we are in a family together, and as is the case in any sort of relationship, there are mutual obligations that we have. Mutual obligations that we have when we work together in the congregation, mutual obligations that we have when we are engaged in a business relationship, mutual obligations certainly when we have a family. What do we owe to our children? Some people, of course, live their whole life for their children. Others seem to see the children as sort of an ancillary to their life. What exactly do we owe to our children? And I'll begin with this. The first thing that I think we need to have in raising godly children is to have the right attitude toward them. The crux of the issue really is, as in most things, do we have the right attitude as we enter into the raising of children? And the Bible has an interesting attitude about children that seems to be a little contrary to the way in which people in the world today of America think about children. In Psalm 127, many of you already were thinking in terms of Psalm 127, beginning in verse 3 of Psalm 127, "Behold, children are a heritage from the Lord. The fruit of the womb is a reward. Like arrows in the hand of a warrior, so are the children of one's youth. Happy is the man who has a quiver full of them. They shall not be ashamed, but shall speak with their enemies at the gate." And of course, many people will look back at that passage of Scripture. They will want to deconstruct it in the nature of modern hermeneutics and say that was an agricultural environment and every farm family needed a large number of children to work the land. And that's the only reason why we have this kind of attitude about having many children. That today, children are not a benefit. Today, children are a liability. That we don't have large acreage on which to put them to work. A need for children's labor that we find it difficult, in fact, find enough work for them to do. That children are not really seen valuable in America today. In fact, we have a very contrary attitude in America today. People think negatively about children. They're always concerned about the population explosion, which turned out not to be quite the explosion that they thought it was going to be back in the 70s. But there were lots of people who were concerned when my wife and I had four children. We had two, then we had three, and then there's another one. And people say, there's a population problem in the world. In fact, some people even in the church were saying, there's a population problem. And I said, that's not quite the attitude the Bible has about children. Children are a blessing from the Lord. We ought to have children. And I certainly would not encourage people to have more children than they can afford or to have more children than their patience and their strength can bear. But children should be seen as a blessing from the Lord. And sometimes we get a pretty keen sense of that when we see couples who just assumed when they got married they would have children, and then because of some kind of medical difficulty of some sort that was unforeseen, they can't have children, and the days and the months and the years stretch on without being able to have children. And we recognize the kind of emptiness that comes out of that sort of experience. Children are a blessing from the Lord. Not only does Psalm 127 say that children are a blessing from the Lord, it says that they are the heritage from the Lord. And children are indeed our heritage. And sometimes, of course, when we get toward the end of our lives, get older, we start reflecting back and say, what has it been worth? What have I done? What have I accomplished? What happened to all those dreams when I was a young man? Driving a BMW, living a James Bond style of life. That all disappears pretty quickly when you're carrying a diaper bag and get spit up on your shirt and get in your minivan. But what have I accomplished at this point in my life? Well, I don't know. Maybe there are plenty of things you can point to and say, I built this business or I wrote this book. But truth of the matter is, those things are going to be of limited importance to anybody except you. Some few people may make a great mark in life. But the thing that we can leave behind us will be our children and our children who raise other children. That's a pretty significant input into the future. Assuming, of course, that we have married well, that we have raised our children well, and that we have written a sentence that will last for a long time that can be our heritage. Our children we leave behind us are going to be our heritage. These are the things that we actually leave behind. People know you when they know your children. I've had this experience, and it's kind of eye-opening to me. I'd have students come, and they'd show up in my classroom, and I'd get to know them a little bit here, get to know them a little bit outside of class. They'd be in another course a couple of years, and then their parents show up for graduation and say, I'm glad to meet you. And I say, I feel like I know you already, because I know your children. If you know a person's children, you know something about that person because they have written who they are in the lives of their children. And I don't think a man can be considered a success, no matter how much he has accomplished, if he has failed as a father. It's one of the saddest things that you read in the scripture about those godly men of Eli and of Samuel and of David, and the children that they raised were not a reflection of the kind of godly attitude that they had. One of the great things that you can say at least about Noah was that he saved his own children out of that great flood. Maybe his preaching didn't accomplish a whole lot else with the rest of the wicked world, but he saved his own children. That's a pretty amazing accomplishment. And these children are the crown of old age. And what better could we produce? What more could we want out of life than as we reach the end of our journey and as we end our course here, that there are godly children left behind us who will carry on? That's a heritage that is worth thanking God for. And of course, children are this kind of accomplishment too, in many ways. If a person has raised children well, they have put something into it. Some children are easier than others. There's no doubt about that. You know that from the time they are born. But no child is just going to grow up and be what he ought to be without some nurturing, without some cultivating, without some tending. And that's about as difficult a task as you can undertake. I don't know what kind of work you do, whether you are a programmer or whether you work in some kind of craft or whether you manage people in a company. Whatever it is that you do, it is no more difficult and requires no more attention than that of raising children. Working in porcelain is not more fragile a work than dealing with a child. And working in steel requires no more persistence than it does in raising a child. And writing a sonnet requires no more skill than raising a godly child. Children are a heritage in this sense, that when we have raised godly children, that is a testimony to the fact that we have been accomplishing something worthwhile in the life that God has given us. And think about this one more thing when you think about children and the attitude toward children, is the attitude Jesus expressed in Mark chapter 9, verse 36. Pretty familiar passage recorded in the other Gospels, but Mark 9 and verse 36. Taking a child, he set him before him, and taking him in his arm, he said to them, "Whoever receives one child like this in my name receives me, and whoever receives me does not receive him, but him who sent me." It is, Jesus says, just intrinsically valuable to see a child. And a child is valuable because of what their potential is. And when you see a child in kindergarten, or you see a child who is in high school, you see a young person growing up and you think what potential they have. When you get to be my age, the potential is pretty well gone. We were talking about that the other day. You know, it's like amazingly ephemeral moment that occurs somewhere, sometime. They used to say, boy, he has potential. One of these days, he's going to be a good preacher. He has got real potential. And then one day I heard him say, you should have heard him in his prime. He was really good back in those days. And where that point was, I'm not sure what that one sermon was that I was at my peak. But when you see a young person, they still have potential. There's no telling what they can do. Martin Luther's teacher used to be just noted in the community where he lived and worked for being a rough and tough-minded fellow. And he would walk through the town, and all the people would speak to him, and he would pay them no mind, or at the most give them some churlish kind of reply. And then he would encounter a child in the street, and he would stop, and he would speak nicely to the child and bow to him and bid him a good day. And somebody finally said, "What is this? You don't speak to those of us who are adults nicely at all. And all, each one of these children, you stop and you bow to them." And Martin Luther's teacher would say to them on those occasions, "I know who you are. It is not yet clear what this child will become." There's a great potential, you see, in these children, and we should value them for that. Have the right attitude about children. Everything else flows out of that. Second thing I think that parents owe to their children is the security of a stable home. And this is just an amazing thing to me. We worry in America today about inequality. And we got the one percenters or the 10 percenters. You got the increasing division between the lower class and the upper class, the shrinking middle class. People are worried about inequality. But the greatest inequality that exists in America today, and if they really wanted to do something about it, they would go to the heart of the matter, and that is the difference between intact two-parent homes and single-parent households. No matter how heroically a single mother may work to try and raise her children, she cannot provide them the benefits that God intended for children to have in an intact two-parent family household. And we owe our children when we bring them into the world that kind of environment. That's what God intended. We should provide for them this kind of security. They should never have any doubt about what is going to happen to them in the future because their parents can't get along. Of course, they need physical security. There should be no concern about their being abused physically by their parents. They need mental security. They should have the comfort of having parents who can explain things to them, who can protect them from the mysteries of the world. Nobody. Well, nobody since Mr. Rogers has quite understood the mind of small children, that there's this amazing, magical, dangerous world out there. They have no understanding about it. Only Mr. Rogers would have thought to make up and to sing a song to comfort children, "You can't go down the bathtub drain." My children get nervous about that, and I was like, just get over it. There's no way you can go down there. It's obvious, but that's not the way they think. I was amazed. My oldest son told me after he was already in high school, we were driving down the road and rolled the windows down, and of course 50 miles an hour, the wind's blowing through there, and he said, you know, for years I was worried about that. Because I know you told me to buckle my seatbelt, and I saw this plastic bag in the black, and the wind was blowing, and it kind of blew around like that. Out the window it went, and I was worried I was going to get sucked out of the window. And I said, that's why we have to have our seatbelts on. I said, I never even would have imagined that. They live in a world in which they need some kind of security, of knowing that there are people looking out for them. Their parents are looking out for them. They need this emotional security that they know that they are loved. And of course, young people need, they need all the attention that they can get, particularly as they grow up in this world that's filled with so many kinds of anxieties and insecurities. One of the best pieces of advice that my wife and I got when we had our first child. And, of course, we were like so many parents. I had no idea, you know. They're born, they grow up. The only information I had about raising children was my parents, and I really didn't pay much attention to that when I was growing up, particularly didn't have any memory about what you do with small children. And we went to a congregation where there were a number of older ladies, and they advised my wife and said, you hold that baby, you rock that baby, you cuddle that baby as long as you can. And that's what they need at that age. They need that kind of tender care, physical contact to know that they are loved. And I don't know, you probably can carry that too far. It certainly can be dangerous to a child if it's not mixed with the appropriate other kinds of discipline that you need to provide them. But it's just amazing how much they need that kind of contact, physical comfort. I know, and of course, this is a demonstration of bad parent, but you can't call human child services on me now because they're all grown and out of the household. But, you know, my child was in one of those car seats and he was buckled in, and I was trying to get too much out of the car at one time and under time pressure, and I tumped him out and he fell over, bam, on his face, upside down in the car seat on the asphalt, and, you know, got a little skin up here, but, you know, he was like terrified, just sobbing, you know, and when you hold him and for 30 minutes afterwards, and you hold him, and it's like, and I told my dad later, I said, Dad, it just tears me up, you know, what can I do for him? I just held him and, you know, tried to comfort him and talk to him, and that was all I could do, and I just felt so bad. And my dad looked at me and said, Son, That's the same way it is when they're 30. You just can't pick them up and hold them anymore. And I said, oh, great. What have I got myself into? But you feel that about your children, that they need this emotional support. And maybe holding and cuddling is enough when they're younger. But when they get to be older, they need reassurance as they go out into the world, to school, where there are all those other kinds of children and those other kinds of situations. They need reassurance that they're competent and that they have a safe base to return to when they come back home. And teenagers even need to know that they're loved, even when they disappoint you and disappoint themselves, that there is somebody, at least in the world, who is going to appreciate them. And, of course, we need to give them our love. In that case, that's clearly what God intends for us in the family, because the family is a model of His relationship to us in the church. And God loved us. And He loved us in a way that reassures us no matter what we have done. If we confess our sins, He is faithful to forgive us. He loved us, Romans chapter 5 tells us, even when we were unworthy of love. And we need to owe that to our, we owe that to our children, to give them that kind of reassurance that they are loved in this household. What is it they say about home? It's where when you go, they got to take you back in. And that's the negative side of that, but the positive side of that is if there is a godly home, there's always a place to go back to. There is always a place that you know that they love you and they care for you and they look out for you. And we need to let those in our household know that that's the case. Too many times, children get the sense from their parents that they love them if. What we call conditional positive regard. I will love you if you keep your room clean. I will love you if you're popular at school. I will love you if you get good. I will love you if you're an athlete like I was in high school. Of course, probably the father wasn't that good of an athlete anyway. He just wants to be an athlete to his son who's in school now. But the children end up with this kind of sense of conditional love. I'm only loved if I do this, if I act a certain kind of way. And of course, there needs to be some kind of limitations on what we allow children to do. We need to provide negative consequences for negative behaviors. But in the midst of all of that, they should know that we love them as unconditionally as we know that God, our Father in heaven, loves us. He loved us even when we were at our least lovable. While we were yet sinners, Christ died for us. And our children need to have that sense that we love them that much too. And part of that's going to be a sense of respect. And this was always difficult for me with my children. But even when we are disciplining them, it needs to be discipline that is in their best interest and not just discipline that emerges out of our own frustration. And clearly when we're disciplining them, it should be to treat them as a human being with potential and not to treat them with disrespect or sarcasm or ridicule. We need to provide for them a sense that they are a valuable human being, even when we are castigating them for their mistakes and instructing them in the way in which they ought to behave. Even when we're exercising our parental authority, we need to do it with the dignity of a judge and not the harassment of some kind of a brute on the streets. We need to give them courtesy, even in the household. There should be a certain kind of respect that we demonstrate to them. As long as, of course, they have behaved in the way that they ought to, we can give them wide-ranging kind of freedoms. When they behave inappropriately, then we have to restrict those freedoms. My parents had this great idea. I don't know where they came up with it, because there were three of us boys and we lived in the same room the whole time that we grew up in the household together. Had triple decker bunks, which could put you, if you're on the top, pretty close to the ceiling. I think that's why I have claustrophobia even today. But one of the problems is you don't have your own things. My parents said, here is a three drawer chest of drawers. Each of you has your own private drawer. This is yours, this one's yours, and this one is yours, and you do not go into the other person's drawer We don't go into your drawer. It is your drawer, your private drawer, and nobody ever goes in there. And of course, that, like, a little sense of, you know, respect that they give you, that you have this that's your own. And of course, if you have some legitimate suspicion, maybe like a just cause for a search warrant from a judge that they are engaged in behaviors that are illegal or inappropriate, then you probably could search their drawer. But there's a sense, as long as you're behaving yourself, we respect you and this is yours. We did that for our children, and our kids were very different. One of them was a saver and the other one was a, you know, let's use it up now before it gets away from us. So they would go out and get candy, and you know, the one boy, he would count his all and put it in his private drawer, and the other boy, he would eat it all. So he developed this strategy, the younger one did, that he could snatch stuff from my other children and then put it in his private drawer and shut it and say, that's my private drawer, you can't go in there. And they didn't go in there, they'd come to us, and I remember we spent a long time talking to him about that, you know, that's your private drawer, but that's a stolen goods you're in possession of here, and we're going to have to do something about that. You need to give them a sense of being loved and respected. And fourth, we need to give them our time and our companionship. You know, this is a tough call for parents in the world today, that we have this alternative almost always constantly before us. I can take this job, I can work these extra hours, I can have this extra income, and I can do this for my children. Or I can stick with the job that I have and I can have more time at home with my children. And that's a constant kind of a pull that we have, and you've got to make the decision for yourself about what is best in your own circumstances and best for your children. But you have to give them some time. See, I think that was probably Samuel's problem. As godly a man as Samuel was, his children turned out as terrible as Eli's children did. And a part of the reason for that, I think, as you read in 1 Samuel chapter 7, is he was on that circuit from Bethel to Gilgal to Mizpah, judging Israel and all of those places. Godly work indeed, but he lost his children, I think, because he did not tend to them and spend the time with them that he should. And of course, as we were talking just yesterday about husbands living with their wives with understanding, there's a difference between just being in the house and actually living with and spending time with the children. And, you know, that is just not going to work out that you are just in the house, but you're ignoring your children and you say, look, I'm giving them all this time. Truth of the matter is, most surveys indicate that fathers with school-age children spend less than 10 minutes a day interacting with their children in ways other than scolding or disciplining them. And then sometimes the father will say, I spend all day working to make ends meet, and then I come home and I, you know, I just am exhausted. I don't have time for my children. Well, you should make time for those children, because what are you working for anyway? Remember the right attitude? They are your heritage. That's what you're going to leave behind. Not the 60 hours a week that you worked 50 weeks out of the year. Those children are what you're going to leave behind. You need to spend time with them. And sometimes, of course, parents in the 80s, they developed this idea they would spend quality time with their children as opposed to just spending a lot of time. They would do their jobs, and particularly mothers would get a job and they'd be away from their children, but they would schedule quality time with their children. They'd have date night with their children where they were going to spend this special time with them. And of course, that's better than nothing. But have you ever tried to schedule time with a child? You ever tried to schedule quality time with a child? It's pretty hard to do. You got to spend a quantity of time with child before the quality moments emerge. And you never know exactly when those quality moments are going to be. It's like the old story, the ambassador, United States ambassador to England, and he wrote in his diary, he kept a diary every day, and his son kind of tried to keep a diary too because his father kept a diary. And the father wrote in his diary one day, wasted day, spent it with my child fishing. And in the child's diary, it said, greatest day of all, fishing with my dad. You never know what's going to be significant to a child, but you will know this. You spend enough time with them, there's going to be quality time. There are going to be things that are significant. and the opportunities you have to interact with them. You never know exactly how much time you got to spend with them before they say, oh, there's a question I've been meaning to ask you. You got to give them the quantity of time before those quality moments of conversation can occur. And of course, that doesn't mean that we're supposed to be buddy-buddy with our children. We should be, of course, on friendly terms with them, but we are their parents and not their pals. They have lots of pals, but they only have one father and one mother, and that's a very special kind of relationship. I read this letter from Ricardo Montalban to his son years ago. Ricardo Montalban, some of you may know Ricardo Montalban, an actor from the old school, Khan in Star Trek, maybe, Love Island, whatever. But Ricardo Montalban wrote to his son, and he said to him in the midst of this letter, I am not your pal. Our ages are too different. We can share many things, but we're not pals. I am your father. This is 100 times what a pal will ever be to you. I am your friend, but we are on entirely different levels. You will do in this house as I say, and you cannot question me because whatever I ask you to do is motivated by love. This will be hard for you to understand. Here's the great line, and all the kids are waiting for it. Until you have a son of your own, and then you will understand. Until then, trust me. And of course, every parent here, I suspect, has heard that as a child from their parents and has said that to their children. And every time a child hears that, it's like, there is no way that can be true. There is no way that having a child can make that much difference in your understanding of the world. But those who have been children and are now parents know exactly what that means. You will not understand it until you have children of your own. One of the greatest models, once again, for our relationship with our children and spending time with them is God and his relationship to us as our Father in heaven. He has not withheld himself from us. He is constantly available to us in prayer. And we need to take advantage of that. And we need to spend time with our children as we model our Heavenly Father. And that means listening to them. Because the truth of the matter is, no matter what your children say, whether they are smaller or whether they're teenagers and struggling to create an identity of their own, parents are important to children, and what you say is important to them. And what is really more important is that you listen to what they have to say. Once again, that's one of the most common complaints that you hear in family counseling, is for a child to say, my parents don't understand me. And of course, you know, we get stuck in this teenage angst that it's like the greatest thing in life to realize and to assert nobody understands me because I'm so special that I'm just not understandable by these other ordinary people. But the truth of the matter is, even in those teenage years and that kind of angst is the fact that they want to be understood. And the most important people in the world they want to understand them are their parents. And we don't listen to them. I was talking to a fellow the other day, and he was asking me some advice about his child, and you know, he was explaining the difficulties they had in this particular conversation, and he told me in great detail everything he said to his son, and what he was thinking, and why he was saying it to his son, and I said, what did your son say? And he gave me just a few kind of general sort of comments about, well, maybe he said this. I said, you know, that wasn't a conversation. You were just lecturing. You didn't listen to what he had to say. All you were thinking about was what you were thinking and what you were saying. You got to listen to what they have to say. It may or it may not change what you intend to do in terms of the particular situation or the consequences that are going to occur. But you need to understand them, and they need to know that you've listened to them and understood them. Here's a thing, too, that occurs on the other side. Parents of teenagers say, my child never tells me anything. So why don't they tell you anything? Probably because you didn't cultivate the habit of them telling you things. When they're younger, they'll tell you anything. And you've got to continue that practice. You've got to listen to them. You know, there's that great line in Indiana Jones, the third movie or something with Sean Connery, and Indiana Jones is complaining to his father and says, "You never paid any attention to me." And his father said, "Well, why should I? You left home just when you were getting interesting." You know, kids get interesting after a while, and you want to talk to them. You want to know what's going on in their lives, but you better have listened to them when they were younger, and maybe not quite so with that incessant chatter about their toys or, you know, what happened at school. I mean, one of my fondest memories, coming home from school, and my mother would be in the kitchen working on supper, and I would sit on the stool there, and she would give me a cookie, and I would just chatter away about what happened in school, and she listened to me every day. I mean, and when I got children of my own, I thought, man, what an amazing gift that was. Amazing that she took that time to listen to five children about all the things that went on in their lives. Because we had children, and we read the little Pokey Puppy. And I'd read the little Pokey Puppy, and somehow they like to read that inane book. I can't tell you, I must have read that inane book 100 times to my kids, maybe more than that. But they want to hear it, and you got to spend time with them, and you got to listen to them talk about his tongue-a-lung hanging out on this page. And you know that's what they're going to say, but you got to cultivate that habit so they will talk to you when you really need to hear what is going on in their lives. Fifth thing that we owe our children is our example. And example, of course, is the best teacher. Some people say example is not the best teacher. It's the only teacher. Sometimes it's the only language that children understand. The old adage is, "Daddy, I can't hear what you're saying. Your example is speaking too loudly to me." I have one friend, and he tells his children, I heard him say that to his child, "You can use any language that you hear me use." And that's the kind of life that we ought to live so that our children can follow our example. And of course, you know, one of the great things, I was amazed about this. I thought, you know, the difficulty with raising children would be that it was so hard to teach them anything. But I found out the real difficulty occurs too frequently because they learn too easily. They learn too quickly. You make one exception to your rule, and that's what they'll remember. I guarantee you that. And you try and explain to them why there's an exception to the rule. And it's like, that's when you know how kind of faulty your own reasoning is, when you can't explain to a five-year-old why you're eating in the living room tonight, and that's the rule is against eating in the living room. You have to provide an example for them. And that example is going to overwhelm whatever kind of instruction that we give them. We ask ourselves these questions so frequently about how can I ensure my child is going to be a godly person? How can I ensure that they're going to take their responsibilities seriously? How can I ensure that they're going to treat their friends in the right kind of way? Best way to ensure that is that they should see that example in you on a daily basis. The crux, really, of the problem for men is not, are you in charge of your family? The crux of the issue is, are you in charge of yourself? Because if you're in charge of yourself and you provide the right kind of example, it makes the rest of it pretty easy. And of course, the sixth thing, and this is what everybody wants to talk about, but I think you can't really talk effectively about discipline until you've talked about these other aspects of raising children. Clearly, we owe our children discipline. That's kind of the pinnacle of the responsibility that parents have in raising children, to raise them in the nurture and the admonition of the Lord. But I'll say this about discipline. Discipline is the same word as the word disciple. And discipline means two things. It means instructive discipline and punitive discipline. And let us not ever presume that the full import of the word discipline falls on the category of punishment. You have to instruct them first. Deuteronomy chapter 6, verses 6 through 9. We had the opportunity to make one of these contributions one time where they give you a brick, you know, and they inscribe, you know, a little something on the brick when you give them such and such a contribution. And so we have our names on there and our children's names on there. And I had inscribed on there also Deuteronomy 6, 6 through 9. And every parent should have this engraved and inscribed in their heart. Deuteronomy 6, 6 through 9. These words which I command you today shall be in your heart, and you shall teach them diligently to your children. And you shall talk of them when you sit in your house, and when you walk by the way, and when you lie down, and when you rise up. And you shall bind them as a sign on your hand, and they shall be as a frontlet between your eyes. And you shall write them on the doorpost of your house and on your gates. And that kind of sums up all of these things that we've been talking about. You spend the time with your children to talk to them about righteousness when you walk by the way, and when you lie down, and when you rise up. It's a frontlet on your arm. It is written in your heart. It is written on the doorpost of your household. And I go in many homes, and they will have, you know, various kinds of signs or posters that have godly phrases on them, righteous terms on them, Bible passages on them. And that's great, but it really needs to be written in the way in which you live your life. Because the thing we need to do is instruct our children. Average child these days, school-age child, is going to get 50 hours of screen time. And that's going to be a lot of information. 50 hours a week of screen time. That's a lot of information. And most of it is not godly. Most of it is not going to have, at the best, is going to be neutral so far as spiritual values are concerned. But much of it is going to be contradictory to the general attitude that Christians ought to have toward the world. It takes a lot of instruction to override that kind of message. And we need to understand how significant the peer pressure of this day and age is on children. I don't know where they get it from, probably certainly from the media, maybe from the fact that we pile children into child-regulated environments at preschool and at kindergarten and at elementary school at an earlier age, but they are very aware of what other children are wearing and what kind of activities other children are engaged in. Peer pressure starts at a younger age in our society. Children of three know what kind of shoes they ought to wear and what kind of cereal they ought to eat from this kind of media peer pressure and the need to conform to what the peers are doing is just overwhelmingly powerful for many children. The key to that probably, of course, is insecurity. They don't want to be different. They want to be accepted. We need to give them the right relationship with us. We need to fill their minds with our kinds of instruction so that we can counteract that peer pressure. And of course, instruction is a big part, the biggest part, I think, of discipline. But there's going to be a need for some kind of punishment. Proverbs chapter 23, do not withhold correction from a child, for if you beat him with a rod, he will not die. You shall beat him with a rod and deliver his soul from hell. And of course, I have to say this to you. That passage is written in the context of Psalm 127, where it says that children are the heritage of the Lord, and that they are the arrow in the hands of a warrior, and blessed is the man whose quiver is full of them. That passage was written in the context of a child-centered culture. It was written in the context of families that loved their children, that doted on their children. Unlike America today, which is a pretty punitive society, it's really the way we think about solving most problems in America today is some kind of punishment, some kind of law and order. And, you know, that admonition in Psalm 23 rings very differently in that kind of a context. It is necessary to correct children, and it's necessary to punish them sometimes. And spanking is a really great way to do that when you're talking about small children. Trying to reason with a one-year-old or a two-year-old, that's going to be pretty difficult. But a quick swat to the hand gets the message across. It corrects the behavior, and then you can move on with the relationship from there. Now, whether you continue to spank children or use the rod on them as they get older than that is going to be a tough call because it teaches them something you don't want to teach them. That is the lesson they learn, if you're not careful, is the way in which you solve problems is by physical coercion. By the time they get older and you can reason with them, you should have gotten to a point where you can use other sorts of punishment as opposed to just spanking or corporal punishment. And of course, every every household has their own kind of rules and their own kind of punishment for the violation of those rules. But I will tell you this, there has to be consequences, both positive and negative consequences, for breaking the rules and obeying the rules. And parents need to be consistent about that, and they need to make sure that the children understand what the rules are and the reason for the punishment. Primarily among all of this stuff, however, is that discipline should let love shine through. The message of all punishment should be, we love you too much to let you continue to behave in this fashion. Lots of other things I can say about that. I think probably I had a couple questions that I will address this in a little more detail when we do the question and answer series after the sermon this evening. But I do appreciate your attention, and I don't want to abuse your time. I think with the motion that's going on, that it's probably time for us to conclude our lesson for today. I did want to say that children owe their parents something, too. They owe them honor, and they owe them obedience. And I'd love to talk about that some more, but another occasion for that. I appreciate your attention.